From the land of the Grand University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the closing market report. It is the 29th day of January, 2024. I'm Extension's Todd Gleason. Coming up, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Kurt Kimmel. He's at agmarket.net. We'll hear from Mark White from the University of Illinois, an agricultural economist that is explored on the Farm Doc Daily website, an article you can read today right now at farmdocdaily.illinois.edu. The transfer of wealth payments that come through Social Security and Medicare and SNAP and Medicaid and many other ways to rural and urban Americans, how that is parceled out and which places in America are likely to receive more transfer of payments than others based on income. And then as we wrap up our time together, we'll discuss the agricultural weather forecast too. That with Mark Russo at Everstream Analytics on this Monday edition of the Closing Market Report. From Illinois Public Media online at willag.org.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
March corn today settled at $4.40¼. It was down 6. The May futures 5¼ lower, settled at $4.50½ for the afternoon. December contract on the day settled at $4.74½, down $0.03¼. And the March beans at $11.94¼, down 15 cents. May futures 11¼ lower, $12.05. And November futures, new crop at $11.80¼, down 4¾. Bean meal futures up $5.30. The bean oil down $1.38. Wheat futures soft red down 6¾. It settled at $5.93½ in the March. The hard red at $6.18¼ in that lead March, down 6½¢. Live cattle futures for the day 45¢ lower. Feeder cattle down $1.07½, and lean hogs 17½¢ higher. Crude oil, $1.48 lower at $76.54 a barrel. Diesel fuel at $2.78½, about 2¢ lower. And gasoline on the RBOB at $2.25¢, 6¢ lower per gallon on the wholesale price. We're now joined by Kurt Kimmel at agmarket.net to discuss the marketplace. Hello, Kurt. Thank you for being with us. I was rather hoping that there would be a better picture to talk about today than there was at the end of last week, but it appears things continue to head lower. Can you tell me about today's trade?
Yeah, there was a little bit of optimism that maybe we could hold together here, particularly in the overnight trade. We were kind of steady, kind of mixed, and kind of held in there. And that was a theme until we moved into the early morning hours here this morning, and things just kind of rolled over, eroded away. Probably the top headlines was the troops there in the Middle East being hit by a drone, and therefore that escalated some tensions overnight, and crude oil is quite a bit higher, and there's ideas that there may be a little risk premium into the marketplace. But as we moved into the day session here, we've seen that kind of push to the back burner. In fact, crude oil is down $1 a barrel here, so we've got fairly good reversal, price reversal to the downside after trading higher overnight and finishing lower during the day here. But also, too, news that China's economy is still in question. Last week, there's a little optimism that the stimulus package will help that market. But what we saw was one of the largest property developers in China was foreclosed on. So the property concern continues to be a thorn in the side. And that questions overall demand. Demand, we've not seen a whole lot of new bean sales for the most part. Most of the trade starting to focus on the southern hemisphere. Brazil's estimated to be about 11% harvested versus 5% last week and 5% last year. And the significance of that is the trade was kind of geared towards, you know, a little slower, later harvest, but the harvest activity starting to pick up and put some beans out there on the world market a little bit sooner. Then probably the thing that kind of pushed the market below the support levels and kept it was defensive. We saw talk of the imports of beans into North Carolina. That happens just about every year. But this is the earliest I think the trades have seen those beans being imported into that region for feed needs. The beans were heavily discounted. I believe they were $1.35 discount basis of the March future. So for the North Carolina area there, that kind of penciled to do that. So that was kind of the nail in the coffin there to keep the market defensive for the most part of the day there, Todd.
You mentioned the technicals. What are you watching there, and what did we go through?
The key support area coming into this week was the previous low here, like in March beans, the leak contract at 1201. We moved below that level. We closed at 1149. Failure to get back about $12 opens the door to go back and test that contract low we had there last summer. I believe it's around 1146. So there's about 50 cent downside risk in the soybeans if we just can't get a turnaround Tuesday. No pressure on Wayne. But also, the corn's down here, the March corn's down to the recent lows. The low was 436. It closed at 440. So it's kind of hold that previous low, but it seems like corn's got some support or some buying interest here at this 435, 440 area zone. They might go down and clean out some stops. So corn's going to be technically tested here in the next few days on that. The thing too to remember, the funds are heavy, heavy shorts. And therefore, hopefully they'll want to do some month-end bookkeeping here in the next 2 days, as we're going to rapidly close out the month of January here in the next 2 days.
What are you watching the rest of this week?
Friday. Friday's going to be a big day, Todd. We got Groundhog Day, so we'll see if the groundhog sees a shadow or not. We were at the Gordyville Farm Show last week, had a lot of conversation on a lot of different topics and so forth, but a lot of wise tales. A lot of this fog that we've seen, some guys mentioned that fog in January here produces a wet spring. So we'll be looking forward to some of these forecasts here to see how soon we get in the field. And of course, a little bit longer term, we'll be talking about the acreage mix. And we'll be having a wealth of information next week here, Todd, as the ag market teams puts together a big seminar here first part of next week. And we'll have some fairly good speakers, and we'll be more willing to pass on those comments here once we get back from Nashville next week.
Oh, yeah, that should be a good trip. You and Wayne Nelson, along with Matt Bennett, a few others that we talked to as well, will all, I think, be down there. I'll be looking forward to hearing what you hear from that area of the world. Also, on the livestock sector, I think Wednesday of this week, there is a fairly important cattle set of numbers that are due out. You usually take a look at the hogs and the livestock, and you already talked, of course, about some of the soybeans that came into the southeast to feed both the poultry and the pork herds there. So should be an interesting week, I suppose.
Yeah, we've got the cattle inventory report, and the big issue there is heifer retention. See if we're rebuilding the beef herd of the equation. But on the flip side of that here, if these lower markets in here, the input cost feed side of the equation is helping take the edge off on some profitability numbers there, Todd.
Hey, thanks much.
You bet. Take care.
You too. That's Kurt Kimmel. He is with agmarket.net. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. We're now joined by Mark White. He is in the Department of Agricultural and Consumer Economics here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the U of I, and has written an article for the FarmDoc Daily website. You can search it out. The title is "The Contributions of Government Transfer Payments to Personal Income." Now, I found this article really interesting because it tracks the transfer of wealth or taxpayer dollars moving through the system to individuals. I think that is a simplified version of what we're looking at. Not all dollars, but some dollars. Can you Tell me what you were hoping to accomplish.
Just hoping to see who what areas are reliant more on government dollars than other areas. A lot of these transfer payments to individuals, they include things like benefits related to retirement and disability, medical benefits, as well as income maintenance benefits or unemployment insurance. For a lot of folks, these are real lifelines for them. It allows these are resources that allow them to meet their basic needs in terms of accessing food or medical care that they need. For a lot of communities, it can be important too, is they may have, or poorer, more disadvantaged communities that these finances can be important sources of spending within a lot of communities, particularly rural communities.
Give me some of the percentages or the data links that you thought were important related to, and we'll talk to them as they're issued and people know them generally in policy, Social Security, Medicaid, Medicare, SNAP, unemployment, those sorts of things. So how much of the personal dollar income in the United States comes from these programs?
So government transfer payments account for about 17 or 18% of the nation's total personal income. This varies from state to state. It's a lot higher in places like West Virginia, where it's almost 29%, New Mexico, 26%, Mississippi, 25%. It's lowest in places like Utah and Colorado, where it's 12 or 13%. Generally speaking, metro counties in the United States, those in more urban areas, government transfer payments are a lower share of total personal income. But in non-metro counties or more rural counties, it's almost one out of every $4 in those counties at 24.5%. The biggest contributors to this are retirement and disability benefits, mainly Social Security. Social Security is 97% of that, the retirement and disability benefits. And that is 5.7% of total personal income in the U.S. overall. Again, higher in rural non-metro counties where there's tends to be an older population. Medical benefits account for just over 8% of total transfer payments as a per share of total personal income, with Medicare being a little over half of that, and Medicaid being kind of the other half of that. Those income maintenance benefits, those are kind of small, those kind of things that really help really disadvantaged people, like the earned income tax credits or SNAP, those tend to be generally pretty small as a share of total personal income. It's 2% overall, but individually each of these programs are small. So SNAP's the, a huge part of the farm bill, but it's really just 0.6% of the total personal income in the United States.
Those numbers really are, sometimes I feel like they're stunning. To think about SNAP, which we talk about in the Farm Bill all the time as the largest part of the Farm Bill, really being a very, very small part of anybody's personal income or of
the overall. For some people, for a lot of folks, these programs are like absolute lifelines for them. But, in terms of just the U.S. kind of personal income overall, yes, it's a very small share of the total.
I should have been very careful about the way I worded that because, yes, they are a lifeline for those who need them. But overall, when you put them into a county or across the whole of the United States, particularly, it makes up very little of the personal income. So in rural areas, for instance, my home county here in Illinois, Logan, is one of the higher users of these particular programs. I'm going to guess that's because of the age of the population, sets between Springfield and Bloomington, but this county seat is 12,000 people, so not very large. Why is it that rural areas, is it just, how much older is that population than a more metro area? What is it that makes those dollars flow into those areas, and we can talk about what that means for the local economy too, I think.
Urban areas, it's so much bigger. There's so many different other sources or ways to generate income and revenue in a place. So it's not that there isn't need in urban areas, it's just that as a share of the total income, it tends to be smaller. In more rural areas, there's less less opportunity for people to generate a living than there is, or less diverse set of opportunities for people to generate opportunities. So those, you know, the government dollars tend to play a bigger role. And yes, rural areas tend to be the older, generally speaking. But the places where government transfers account for the greatest share of total personal income usually have those two characters. One, they tend to be older, and two, there tends to be areas of greater need. So the type of places we're talking about are, you know, the usual places that we think about. So Appalachia, the Mississippi Delta area, some of the tribal areas in the Southwest, the Ozarks in Missouri and Arkansas, these are all places where there's a combination of both older and often, you know, entrenched poverty. So there's huge need in those places. And so, you know, the trends that we see when we look at this reflect both the regional kind of demographics and also the regional needs.
Is there anything you can pull from North Dakota, which you pointed out as one of the places that appears to be an oddity, because you would think that it is extraordinarily rural, that it would be older? Yet it uses, with the exception, I think, of maybe some of the areas where reservations are located, less of these transfer of payments than other rural states.
My guess is that the amount of transfer payments that you see going into North Dakota would be similar to comparable size places, but the income is so much has been greater because of a lot of the other activities that have gone on in North Dakota related to the energy industry. The numerator is consistent with what you see in other places. The denominator would be bigger than what you might expect.
What should we take away? What should we learn from this article? What are you hoping that final conclusion might be?
That there are a lot of places around the country where people are absolutely reliant on these programs. In a way, like I said, they can be a lifeline to a lot of people to allow them to meet their most basic needs. And that, you know, programs like, you know, Medicaid and SNAP, they continue to be, particularly those disadvantaged places, like crucially important for folks. And they're, you know, both as individuals and as communities, they rely on these programs.
Social Security and Medicare as well?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Especially for older Americans, because older Americans benefit from these programs more than any other Americans, because the two leading, you know, categories are Social Security and Medicare. And those benefit older Americans, and even Medicaid, too, for that matter. About 10% of Medicaid goes to, you know, older Americans as well.
Mark White is an agricultural economist here in the College of Agricultural, Consumer, and Environmental Sciences, a member of the Farm Dog team. You can read more from him on the contributions of government transfer payments to personal income on the Farm Dog Daily website today. Let's check in with Mark Russo now. He's at Everstream Analytics. Hello, Mark. Thank you for being with us today.
Hello there, Todd.
Tell me about weather conditions in Argentina first. Over the past, and maybe you can give me some background. I believe it's 3 years, possibly four. They were really, really dry. This year's been way better. Crop size is expected to be twice what it was last year. Last year, really, really rough. Tell me about it, please.
Sure, Todd. Yeah, Argentina last year was a total disaster there. And the past few years certainly has been that way. A lot of that driven by the La Nina event and the colder than normal waters across much of the eastern Pacific Ocean. This year is much different with the El Nino in place, and that has brought about a much more favorable growing conditions this season with a lack of heat and also more abundant and frequent rainfall. Now, the main takeaway right now in the pattern for Argentina is that it has just recently trended drier. In fact, over the past week to 10 days, the pattern has shifted into a drier than normal one for Argentina. And now we're beginning to see some heat build into the region as well. In fact, a ridge of high pressure is in the process of building into Argentina. And that is not only reducing rainfall, but also heating up temperatures. And throughout much of this week on into the first half of next week, it's going to be some very hot temperatures across Argentina, generally in the 90s and some lower 100s, and that is going to begin to decrease crop conditions from, you know, what are right now very favorable and above average conditions. That does look to change here. And by around the February 8th, 9th timeframe, that is going to be the start of a more favorable pattern here for rain, ultimately cooler temperatures and improving, you know, or stabilizing or improving conditions. So, so right now, again, they're turning hot and dry, but in the, you know, what's been a lack of that this season, that continues for about a week or two, but then they go wetter and cooler thereafter.
Do we see the same pattern in southern Brazil as we do in parts of Argentina?
Yeah, parts of Rio Grande do Sul, as well as Paraguay, even Uruguay too. Very similar type of pattern. Now, Rio Grande do Sul has still picked up more significant rainfall here. Well, about a week or so ago, so they've only been drier about 5 or 6 days, but for the rest of the region, it's been a bit longer than that. But again, them too will also start to see better rainfall prospects coming in week two of February.
And in the center west, what are conditions like?
Yeah, center west Brazil continues to have generally favorable conditions for both soybean harvesting as well as early corn planting. Again, the more detrimental weather from heat and dryness was earlier in the growing season for soybeans back in November and early December, and things have been more favorable over the past 4 to 6 weeks. And we see that generally continue here over the next few weeks. There is one area is starting to dry out a little bit here is southern Mato Grosso, but that area looks to see rain next week. So that dry pocket is very short-lived.
After the Arctic blast, the air that came into the United States, we've been much wetter and warmer. Will those conditions persist? And how has this changed what conditions on the ground look like as it's related to the drought monitor, if any, for the western and the central parts of the U.S.?
Yeah, well, Todd, from a temperature standpoint, this unseasonably mild pattern looks to continue across the plains and the Midwest over the next several weeks. There's just simply no sign of the polar vortex returning or any kind of major Arctic cold moving in. As we look out from now through the first, basically the first half of February at least, from a rainfall or precipitation standpoint, this more active pattern in the central U.S., yeah, which is improved soil moisture for the plains hard red belt, also improved soil moisture and river levels here, also caused some localized flooding here in the Midwest, but that looks to continue as well. So, again, much more active pattern and, again, likely tied to this El Nino event as well, which typically produces more normal or even above normal rainfall across the southern Midwest and plains regions.
Hey, thank you much.
You're welcome.
That's Mark Russo. He is with Everstream Analytics. Joined us on this Monday edition of the Closing Market Report. It came to you from Illinois Public Media. It is public radio for the farming world. Find us online at willag.org and pick up your tickets today for the March 5th all-day Ag Outlook at the Beef House in Covington, Indiana. The theme music for the Closing Market Report is written, performed, and produced by Logan County, Illinois farmer Tim Gleason. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.